Hello, everyone, and welcome to COVID-19 Questions and Answers on KASU. I'm News Director Jonathan Reeves, and for the next hour, I'll be joined by my guest, Dr. Shane Spites. He's the Dean of the NYIT College of Osteopathic Medicine at Arkansas State University. We'll be talking about COVID-19 and some of the key concerns related to the pandemic, and also I'll be asking some questions from listeners as well, previously submitted on Facebook. It's a very similar format to what we had when we did this previously. So let me welcome Dr. Shane Spites joining me over Zoom. Dr. Spites, thank you so much for your time. Welcome back to KASU. Appreciate you, sir.
Thank you, Jonathan. Appreciate you having me back, and I'm always eager to speak on a topic that can provide education for our community.
Okay. Let's talk about, we did our first question and answer program a couple of weeks ago, and you had mentioned that there was a lot about COVID-19 that is still unknown. Since we talked last, have health officials been able to learn anything new about the virus?
You know, we absolutely have. Because this is an ongoing virus, an ongoing, health emergency, as we treat patients, as we try different things, we learn. We learn as we're going. So in terms of medications, in terms of testing, in terms of even new symptoms that we're seeing in patients, depending on their age, a lot of new things are coming out. New managements, maybe not everybody needs to go on a ventilator that has low oxygen concentrations. Maybe we could be more conservative in our management. Some of the symptoms that are cropping up that we otherwise weren't familiar with and didn't know about early on, we thought it was just purely a respiratory, virus. Now we're seeing symptoms that could end up being COVID-19 that you wouldn't expect in a normal respiratory virus. So lots of information continues to funnel in almost on a daily basis. It's kind of difficult to even keep up with all of it, but it's good. It's good that we're seeing these research articles coming out, and like I said, the medical literature, the medical evidence is starting to really catch up and keep us all on our toes.
There's been now a concern about symptoms of a Kawasaki kind of disease that has inflammatory syndromes. There's a lot of symptoms that are affecting children right now. This was something that Dr. Fauci had mentioned during a Senate hearing that took place recently. Kind of describe this and how concerning this is for people who have young children.
So that's an inflammatory syndrome that occurs in kids, the Kawasaki's disease particularly. What's interesting about that is at first, we weren't really seeing it here in the United States a couple of weeks ago. And then we started getting reports in Europe, and in the UK, they started seeing cases of this strange inflammatory illness in young children. And then within several days, or so, all of a sudden it started cropping up in New York. So it's odd that we're seeing it now. New York has gone through, as well as Europe has gone through their first peak, so to speak. And now we're seeing this. So that's a little bit of a head scratcher. But the case remains that we are seeing it. It's still very rare, but it does occur in children. And specifically, Kawasaki's disease itself targets the medium-sized arteries in the body. And why that's a concern is because it can affect the heart. And so specifically in the heart, it can affect those. There are specific symptoms and signs that you'll see with that disease. Now, Kawasaki's disease originated actually over in the East, in Japan and in that area. And there's a higher prevalence there. We don't have a very high percentage of individuals here. We kind of, it's on the medical side, we joke and say it's a board question, meaning that when we take our physician licensing exams, we'll get questions about this. It's not common to see it, but you still need to know about it. And so it is interesting that we're starting to see that. It's still a rare phenomenon. It's not something commonly seen at all, but the American Academy of Pediatrics has put out some information to be on guard. And I know that the State Health Department in New York has issued warnings to pediatricians and family physicians to be watching for this because it can happen. And I think the biggest take-home message about this and other inflammatory processes that we're seeing in children is that children aren't immune, and that children can be affected. It is certainly a smaller percentage, as I've said before, but we don't want the public to think that, my 7-year-old is going to be fine. Even if they get infected, there's nothing that happens to them, or, my 10 or 12-year-old, or that sort of thing. So I think the take-home message is that yes, the kids still can get infected. And the other piece, too, is that when we talk about our vulnerable populations, you hear us talk about those over the age of 65 or those that take medications for a chronic condition. We do need to be thinking about our children who have chronic conditions. So we have children that are born with maybe heart defects or maybe born with a syndrome or a certain disease. Those children can be considered in that population as vulnerable. So we want to make sure that we pay special attention to them, those that have severe asthma or an underlying lung disorder, like I said, born with some sort of congenital anomaly. Those kids for sure we would want to pay special attention to.
There's been a lot of people who've been staying at home due to the quarantine. In New York last week, Governor Andrew Cuomo noted that despite the stay-at-home orders, people who had been quarantined were still being diagnosed with it. Now, how can that be, and how concerning is that?
Well, and so the devil's in the details there. The way this virus is spread is person to person. And so if you are truly quarantined in your home and you are not going anywhere and you don't have any exposure to the outside environment, then the risk is almost zero that you'll get infected. However, most everyone at some point is going out and going to the grocery store. You know, even here in our own communities, I think I've seen lots of different Facebook posts and things about the number of individuals who are going to local large businesses and things like that on the weekends, and you know, and just trying to get out. And there's some certainly public fatigue over the pandemic. I think it just underscores how infectious this virus is and how quickly it can be transmitted from person to person, how long it lives on surfaces, and how long it can live in the air for individuals to come pass through an area where a person was infected and infect themselves. And so this is just what we've known and continue to prove, is that this is a very infectious virus.
Dr. Shane Spites joining me here on the COVID-19 questions and answers on KASU. Dr. Spites, as you know, the state has started to ease restrictions on some businesses, allowing people to get back to work. And as things have been going on, we've been seeing more and more people get out. What still concerns you about all of this as people are going back to work and life is starting to go back into what some sort of a normal might be?
Well, I think you hit on the term there, Jonathan. Normal. This is not normal. It shouldn't be normal. We're not going to be normal for a while. So I think we have to be careful about how we approach this. My concern is that individuals falsely assume that the virus is not in our community. It must be okay to go back to work and to go back out into society because the virus is not here. It's not actively circulating. We don't have a lot of cases. We're going to see cases go up. We're going to see cases go up in our region and in our state and really across the country. And current data already shows that that's trending in that direction. Now, readily recognize the economic impact and the fact that we have to get people back to work, and there has to be a balance. However, we're going to see cases go up, and so that people just need to be aware of that, and that's why they probably need to be more diligent than they were previously in terms of how they handle themselves in public. The wearing of masks, the keeping of hand sanitizer in your vehicle so that you can use that when you get in and out, making sure that you still follow social distancing, the 6-foot rule. All of those things are even more important now than they were when we were actually staying more at home.
And so some might ask, well, if we knew that the cases were going up and all of that by way of quarantine and that, why was it necessary to quarantine people in the first place? And should people still be quarantined?
So what we did was we did a really good job of it. We flattened the curve. And you remember the last time you and I spoke, we talked about the importance of limiting the spread of the disease. And certainly here in Arkansas, we've done a really good job of that. What that does, though, is it's still that you have the virus in your community. You just don't, there's several things. The reason why we flatten the curve is so that we don't overwhelm our hospitals and we don't overwhelm our healthcare system. The other reason we do that is it buys us time. There are things that we know now about how to manage a critically ill patient with the COVID-19 that we didn't know 4 weeks ago. So you're much better off if and when you get it down the road to get sicker, when we have more information and more knowledge about how to manage those patients and what to do and what not to do. But again, it is that fine line. Our economy, certainly in a small rural state, cannot tolerate everyone staying at home and no sales tax dollars being generated and no money exchanging hands and individuals that are out of work and not able to pay their bills or to buy their groceries. I mean, so there's a breaking point there as well. So it's, to be honest with you, there was a great article that came out in the New York Times several weeks ago And at first, the heading caught me off guard. I was kind of taken aback by it. But then as I read it, it started to make more sense to me. And it was a group of individuals, of ethicists and biologists and individuals in public health. And the heading of the article said, "We have to reopen our economy and people will die. So how do we do it?" And that's a pretty stark statement. That's a pretty bold statement to say. And it kind of catches you off guard. But there's some truth to that. We know that people are going to get sick, but we also know that we can't just sit at home for the next 6 months and wait for this virus to die out on our own. So how do we manage this as an individual and manage it as a community and as a state and as a U.S. Government so that we can do it safely?
Dr. Shane Spites is joining us here. He's the dean of the NYIT College of Osteopathic Medicine on the campus of Arkansas State University here on KASU. Nathan had one question here as he's going back to work, as many people are going back to work. Some people are really concerned about going back to work and catching the virus. What can employers do to help address some of those concerns from employees?
So in terms of the employer-employee side and being able to basically safely return to work, the CDC has some really good guidance, and it's specific to certain industries and certain business sectors. So I highly recommend looking at the CDC website and seeing what they have laid out. And it's very prescriptive, which I think is good. I think certainly in this time, in the time of a pandemic, we need to be as prescriptive as we can to make sure that we protect ourselves and protect those populations that are at highest risk. And so simple things, and I'll just tell you what some of the things that we're doing, we're going to be doing at NYIT when we go back. We'll be doing meetings much like this one through Zoom, even if we're down the hall from each other. So even if we're in the same building or even in the same suite, we'll have meetings, but it'll be over a virtual platform. We won't be having large groups meeting together. We won't have large groups of students meeting together. And so we'll be using and leveraging technology to be able to maintain the day-to-day functions of the college, but doing it safely. The only virus I can catch from you over this medium is one from my computer, Jonathan. And so I'd rather have that happen than have it be COVID-19.
Very true. Very true. Do you think that when people are out and about that people should be wearing masks more? Do you think there should be stronger enforcement on how people wear masks?
My personal opinion is yes. Let me qualify that, though. I do believe people should be wearing masks. I think the masks protect you. I think they protect the people around you. Do I think there should be enforcement of that? No. I think there should be education. I think when we start putting enforcement in place and mandating things, I think you're just asking for pushback. Because to be honest with you, do I like wearing a mask in public? No. Do I want to wear a mask in public? No, I don't. It's not comfortable. You know, I have hard times breathing sometimes through it. And, you know, if I'm walking. And so I'm not, I don't like actually putting it on. Do I do it because it protects me and it protects those around me? Absolutely. So it's a sacrifice that I'm willing to make because of public health and because of my own health. But I understand it. I understand the virus. I understand how the virus is transmitted. I understand, some of the bad outcomes that can occur from the virus. I think until our communities are fully educated on really what we're looking at and what we're facing, I think you're going to see a variable adherence to some of these recommendations and some of this guidance. I don't think it ought to be a statewide or even, city or countywide mandate that everybody has to wear a mask out in public. I know there are some specific directives that the governor has put out, certainly like in restaurants and in large or small venues, and I think that's appropriate. But for the average person, I don't think that it should be that there's a mandate for me to have to wear a mask if I'm going from here to, a local grocery store or things like that in terms of a mandate. Now, I will do it because, again, I understand the virus and I understand the importance, and I think we should spend more time on the education than we should actually the mandate piece, if that makes sense.
It really does. And it kind of leads into the next question I would ask you about education, because there are two things that I've seen that I wanted to ask you about. Talking about masks, I've gone to grocery stores and that, and I've seen people who wear masks, and I think that they're wearing them inappropriately. What I mean by that is you're covering the mouth, maybe not covering the nose. Maybe you're doing, maybe you're not even really wearing the mask at all. Kind of tell us about that, about the proper way to be able to wear a mask.
So that's a really great point. I've witnessed that same thing, Jonathan. And so what people need to realize is the mask really only works in terms of protecting you or protecting others if it's fully covering your nose and your mouth. And so it needs to cover basically the areas that, you're breathing in and out of. And so that would be in through your nose and out through your nose and in and out through your mouth. And so the mask needs to fully cover those areas. You need to wear it when you're in public. So basically outside of your, before you get out of your vehicle, you put the mask on. When you come back from wherever you are and get back into your vehicle, as you take the mask off, you should immediately use a alcohol-based hand sanitizer and sanitize your hands. Because there is risk of infection in terms of you infecting yourself from your mask. And so these masks should be washed. You know, most of the cloth masks, for sure, you can do that, you know, depending on how active you are out in the public, would dictate the frequency of how often they should be washed.
And I use the term inappropriate. I meant incorrectly. So I hope you understand that I meant incorrectly and not inappropriately by way of using masks. The use of gloves, there are some people who've used the same pair of gloves maybe during their entire shifts while they're on the job. What's the proper way for glove use to help reduce the spread of COVID-19?
So in terms of the gloves themselves, the biggest thing that people need to understand is how you take the gloves off. And that's kind of a skill, so to speak. It's great that you're using the glove as long as while you have the gloves on, you're not touching yourself, touching your face. Defeated the purpose of wearing the gloves if you do that and infect yourself. You need to realize that as you're wearing gloves, any surface that you touch may get that glove infected, which is fine, it's protecting you, but then you may carry the virus to another location. So if you're working in one area and you have gloves on and you move to another area and the virus is on your gloves, you just move the virus from one area to another. Now, as long as everyone's wearing gloves, and everyone's protected that way, then it's not as big of a deal. Obviously, in a perfect world, which is what we do in the healthcare side, we change gloves frequently. We change gloves between patients. You don't cross-contaminate one patient to the next. And so we'll use gloves. And that's why, like in a hospital room or even in a clinic room, you'll see the boxes of gloves, and they'll be used for that individual patient, and then they're discarded, and then you'll go on and use a different pair for another patient. Sometimes that's not feasible in industry or in the workplace. In terms of taking the gloves off, there's a way, and I'm pretty sure you can find it on YouTube, where basically as you have the gloves on, you grasp the inner palm of one and grasp the inner palm of the other, and then you pull outward. And basically what it does is the exterior part of the glove flips inside and becomes the interior part. And so that way, anything that you've touched with those gloves, ideally any virus or even bacteria that you've touched, remains inside and covered, and you can then discard it. And then obviously wash your hands with soap and water or utilize an alcohol-based hand sanitizer.
You're listening to COVID-19 Questions and Answers. I'm Jonathan Reeves. We'll return with our guest, Dr. Shane Spites, after this break. You're listening to KASU, streaming live at kasu.org. This is COVID-19 Questions and Answers on KASU. I'm News Director Jonathan Reeves. My guest this hour, Dr. Shane Spites, who's the Dean of the NYIT College of Osteopathic Medicine at Arkansas State University. Dr. Spites, thank you for joining us as always. We really appreciate your time.
Thank you, Jonathan. Happy to be here.
Dr. Nate Smith with the Arkansas Department of Health last week specifically mentioned Jonesboro as a new hotspot for the virus, but then he kind of clarified that when you're taking a look at hotspot, it's not like a Louisiana hotspot, but we're seeing some spikes in that. Are there steps that city and county officials need to be taking in response to this after Dr. Smith said that about making mention of Jonesboro being a hotspot?
Yeah, I was actually watching the press conference at that time, and I was a bit surprised, as you might imagine. I've been following these numbers pretty closely, and certainly following the numbers here in Craighead County and in Northeast Arkansas. There were some areas in Northeast Arkansas that we were seeing an uptick on, but I certainly would not have classified it as a hotspot. And the numbers at that time didn't really reflect a spike in our area. The truth is, we do expect cases to go up. Cases, as we continue to loosen social distancing requirements, as we start to open things back up, cases will go up. There were areas here in Northeast Arkansas, specifically Crittenden County. We were seeing some there in Mississippi County that were going up. And so the big thing is that in terms of what can we do, we need to continue reinforcing the CDC guidelines. Really, the CDC has done a great job, I think, putting a lot of this together. And I think they are pretty prescriptive in terms of what they have. And I think that that's what we should be using. And in terms of how we should move forward, not only as a nation, but as a state and as a county and as a city.
Marcy asked this question that there are two words that have now come into the conversation. That's contact tracing. Tell us about that. What is that and why is contact tracing needed?
So contact tracing is basically, this is the way it works. We find out, or you find out, you're infected. We need to know who you came in contact with over the last couple of days so that we can notify them so that they can then self-quarantine in case they are infected. The idea behind that is to get a handle on the virus. And so we need to know everybody that they came in contact with so that we can try to limit the spread. This is still an attempt to try to reduce the number of people that are getting infected. There are things that we don't have that we can't use right now. We don't have things that we would use normally for influenza, which is why we don't really do it for that. You know, we've got lots of things in place. We've got a vaccine. We've got medicines that you can take by mouth. We could call into any pharmacy. We've got rapid testing available at any given time. We don't have any of that right now for COVID-19. So to be honest, this is the best we can do, is that once we identify somebody who's positive, go back and find out who they came in contact with over the previous 48 hours or so and notify those individuals. Those individuals then need to take precautions to protect themselves to, again, limit the spread. All of this is an attempt to basically limit the widespread disease transmission.
How would you address some concerns to say that this might be something that's intrusive?
It is intrusive. I'll be honest. And some of the things that are done in other countries would not be tolerated here in the United States. I typically use South Korea as an example of a country that seems to be doing it right. They have the ability to track individuals on their cell phones. And so last week there was a case where an individual turned up positive. They were able to trace the 1,000 people that individual came in contact with and notify them that they needed to self-quarantine. We can't do that here. People would not likely tolerate someone following them around or knowing where they are on their cell phone through a GPS app. I think there'd be too much concern that once the pandemic is over, they would just continue to be followed and tracked and traced. And so that's going to limit our ability to truly do this, because we're kind of back to, okay, we're going to call you and ask you. And hopefully you're forthcoming, or hopefully you can remember everybody you came in contact with, or, you know, at 10:30 on Saturday, I went to, you know, the local grocery store or local hardware store. And, you know, these are the times that I was there. And so you can see how quickly it becomes a very manpower intensive process. I do worry that we as a state do not have the bandwidth to truly do this once we start seeing large numbers of cases and large clusters of cases and outbreaks throughout our state. I think it's going to be difficult for us to really keep a handle on it without using technology. But to be able to use that technology, people are going to have to be okay with it. And I'm not convinced that they are. You know, we as a country, even before this, were somewhat divided. And so this really boils down to, you know, the right of the individual versus, you know, the right of the public, or the, you know, the health of the public. And I think we've even seen that in the news, how polarizing that can be.
Let's talk about testing. As we see more testing kits are coming to the state, do you think that our testing capacity is adequate right now?
In the short answer, no, I do not. But it's not... It's not any fault of any state. I'll say that it's not, the tests are just not available. They're just not out there. We just don't have the ability to produce in mass numbers the tests that are really required to adequately trace and track this virus and diagnose somebody at the time that they walk in. Testing won't be truly adequate. I mean, we're doing the best that we can, and please don't take it as a criticism of what Dr. Smith and ADH are doing and the governor are doing. I think we're certainly doing the best that we can given the scenario. But until you or any of your listeners can walk into their local doctor's office at any given time and take a rapid test and find out within minutes whether they're positive or negative, I don't think the testing will be adequate. Now, we can do that now with flu. You can do that with strep. You can do that with mononucleosis. I mean, there's lots of things we can do rapid tests for now. We just don't have the platforms, and we don't have the ability to do that. And we won't for some time. So it leaves us kind of chasing the virus, so to speak, because right now the turnaround time is between 12 and 24 hours or even longer, depending on which labs you're using to test for the virus, which means the individual goes home. You're hopeful that they'll self-quarantine, but they may have stopped off the grocery store, stopped off here, stopped off there on the way home as they're waiting for the test result to come back. Testing has improved. Testing has improved quite a bit over the last several weeks or so. I'm excited that we're getting more tests for the state of Arkansas. But we need to be able to test anyone, anywhere, pretty much at any time. And I still think we're far away from that.
And that has to be a real concern if we know that there could be more waves coming, possibly later this year, maybe into the fall and the winter. That has to be a huge concern.
You're absolutely correct. There's if we're really limited right now in terms of the tests that we can provide, what's going to happen when there's a significant uptick and we really need to do more testing in certain areas? You know, there's I think large number of tests that are coming to the state soon. Remember, we're a state of about 3 million people. So we need to be able to have testing available, again, pretty much for anybody at any time. We take a lot of this for granted. I think people take for granted when they start feeling bad in the fall, they can just run to their doctor's office and get a rapid influenza screen and find out, you know, and that's great. And we have several manufacturers that produce those tests, and we have large volumes and large supplies of those tests. And, you know, doctor's offices don't worry about getting those tests in. They get large numbers in every year and can get as many as they need. I think that's the kind of healthcare we're used to, and we just don't have that now. And again, it's not placing blame, it's just the reality of where we are.
So let's talk about those people that are doing a great job on the front lines. And I know that you all are training the next classes of people that are on the front lines. Some of the students are actually working on the front lines right now. Let's talk about personal protective equipment for healthcare workers. Do you think that's getting any better, or do you think there's still a massive shortage? We have a long way to go there too.
I think it's better. I do think that we still have very, very tight supply chains. And I do believe that there are private physicians out in practice. Actually, I know of this, that even throughout our state, and I've lots of articles on this as well and updates, there are still shortages of the frontline physicians not having it for their own clinics. The hospitals are getting what they need for the most part to take care of the critically ill and the hospitalized COVID patients. But there's really not enough for everybody to have everything they need out in the clinic space and the urgent cares. So there's some rationing that's going on in terms of the utility of the PPE. Luckily, the CDC has put out guidance in terms of how best to do that in a shortage time frame in terms of when we're not having, we don't have a lot. And so that's been very helpful from the CDC standpoint. I don't think there's enough for the fall for sure right now. So I think hopefully what everybody is doing is they're trying to stockpile as much as they can with the anticipation of, just as you mentioned, more spikes in cases in the coming fall.
Now, I saw a report. I haven't seen the latest numbers, so these numbers are different. Please feel free to correct me on this, Dr. Spites. But the CDC had a report on their morbidity and mortality that said that about 20% or almost 20% of those diagnosed with COVID-19 across the country were healthcare workers. And if that number has changed, please feel free to correct me on that. But kind of, I want to get your thoughts on that about, and that seems to be very, very alarming, very concerning that many people who are working on the front lines, healthcare workers, are contracting COVID-19.
Absolutely, Jonathan. That number is probably smaller than what's anticipated. I'll tell you, I'm familiar with that number. In addition, there's recent information that about 33 to 35% of the deaths from COVID-19 in the United States have been from nursing home residents or nursing home workers. So individuals that are either in as a resident in a nursing home or as a worker in a nursing home, about 33 to 35% of the deaths have been from that sector. It should not be surprising that frontline individuals who are coming in contact with this virus are then getting themselves infected. And I think this is important for your listeners to understand. That number will shift, and it will shift to a different population in the fall. It will shift to include teachers, bus drivers, cafeteria workers, K-12 administrators, and university and college faculty and staff. As we have colleges and K-12 open up in the fall, we will see those infections shift into those areas. Because I think people may not remember what we did here in the United States and what we did here in Arkansas. Remember, we closed down schools really at the very beginning of this. And so nationwide, you started seeing these school closures, and college and universities went online, and people vacated their college campuses even before spring break, which was great in terms of limiting the spread. Now all of those groups will be coming back together in August, and we will see circulation of the virus within those areas. So your frontline workers now are your doctors and your nurses and your healthcare staff. Your frontline workers in the fall is your elementary school teacher and your counselor and your principals and the individuals that are going to be working in the colleges and universities.
You're listening to COVID-19 Questions and Answers. I'm Jonathan Reeves. We will return with our guest, Dr. Shane Spites, as you're listening to KASU. This is streaming live on KASU.org. Welcome back to COVID-19 Questions and Answers. As we continue asking questions, we're talking this hour with Dean of the NYIT College of Osteopathic Medicine, Dr. Shane Spites, as we now will continue with our questions off of Facebook. Recently, you released a commentary, Dr. Spites, saying that we are far from the finish line. For those who may have not heard that on KASU or read that in the Jonesboro Sun or other areas, kind of tell us about that, if you don't mind, please. What did you mean by that?
So basically what I was saying by that commentary is that the virus is still here. The virus is in our community. It's still circulating, and you can still get infected. And in fact, you're probably going to be at a higher risk of being infected as more people get out and start moving around the community and start going shopping, and they're more active and they're not limiting their time at home. And so that was the point of the article, was really to try to provide some education for the general public. And we don't want to send the message that, you know, we've signaled the all clear. Okay, everything's good now. You know, we spent time at home. The virus is gone. You can now go about your daily routine. That's not true. That's not true at all. In fact, we were still seeing some increases in cases even as we've started to open back up. I think people may not have recognized that economically we had to reopen. If we were in a perfect world, and people didn't have to work, and we didn't, you know, you could sit back and you had everything that you needed, then yes, we would still be under some sort of stay at home, and we would be waiting for the virus, you know, to really kind of die out. We don't have the luxury of doing that. We have a society and a population that needs to get back to work. We need to generate dollars. We need to generate sales tax dollars. We need, you know, we have things that need to be done to maintain our livelihood. And so it was just kind of the point where we had to make that decision to move forward. But people should understand the virus is very much still here. We will very much continue to see increases in cases, likely. You know, you'll see peaks and valleys over the coming months as we continue to have outbreaks throughout our region, throughout the state and the country.
And I would imagine one of the challenges, there's a lot of challenges when you think about COVID-19, but one of these is how you balance this healthcare crisis, this pandemic, with those growing economic concerns. And I would imagine that's a huge challenge right now.
I'll tell you what, I can't imagine the immense pressure that elected officials and those that are in public health that work for elected officials are under. It's easy for me to basically sit back and look at the data and say, well, you know, this seems like the best course, and I don't have all of that economic information and background that they do. So extremely difficult for our elected officials to make these decisions, knowing that anytime they start to restrict things in terms of social distancing or restrict gatherings, that there's going to be a negative economic impact. By the same token, how do you weigh that with the public health, knowing that, you know, this virus, again, spreads rapidly, can certainly affect certain generations much more severely than others? I can't imagine. I really can't. I can't imagine how difficult that must be.
Doreen wanted me to ask you this question about antibody testing. And she says, are there any developments on antibody testing? And then the second part of the question, do antibodies in the blood protect people from the disease? I guess we'll kind of take that in those couple of questions there. But how would you respond to Doreen's question about that, please?
I think that's a great question. That's certainly a hot topic right now, is the antibody testing. And just so that people that don't understand what that is, so antibodies, ideally, when you come in contact with a virus or a foreign organism, your body recognizes it, it fights it off, and then it creates basically some sort of memory. And so it uses antibodies to create memory to that specific foreign invader. And so if you were ever able to see it again, your body would be able to quickly fight it off as opposed to the initial response that it needed. We can test for those antibodies in the blood. And so the thought is, well, if we can test you and we can see that you've actually come in contact with COVID-19 and have created antibodies, then you should be good to go. And meaning that you should be able to go back to work. You should be able to freely go to restaurants and movie theaters and bowling alleys and whatever you want to do. In theory, that sounds really good. In practice, it's not that easy. And let me just kind of give you some of the background. Right now, there's over 200 antibody tests available in the United States. And a lot of them are what we call junk. So basically, the tests don't work or they give you inaccurate information. Only 12 of those tests have actually been FDA approved through the EUA. The EUA is an emergency use authorization. The way EUA works basically is the FDA tells the company, we don't have time to test and validate what you're saying about your test. We're just going to trust you on it. So we'll let you go ahead and sell this test and we'll put a stamp on it. But the caveat is it's EUA. We'll come back later and we'll test you and make sure that really what you're saying is truthful. So we've got 12 tests out there that have FDA EUA. The problem with the antibody test is we really don't know, to be honest with you, what antibodies they're testing. And is it a certain level? You know, if my antibody level comes back at 3 and yours comes back at 500, does that mean that I'm immune, or does it mean that I just had a little bit of the virus and really not enough to protect me from getting sick again? We don't have those answers. Hopefully, we'll get those answers in the coming weeks and months. But right now, it does not mean that you have immunity just because your antibody test comes back. And there's also a percent false positive rate of that, which is actually pretty low for the most part. But let's say it's a 97% 97% accuracy, and it's only got a 3% false positive rate. Well, that sounds pretty good. That means that only 3 out of 100 does it falsely tell you have those antibodies. Well, when we extrapolate to the U.S. population, all of a sudden now 3% for 300 million people, it's a pretty large number. And now those people may think they have immunity, so to speak, and they in fact can get sick and spread the virus rapidly. And so there are other instances where the antibodies that are detected by the test aren't really the antibody test for COVID-19. It's actually picking up antibodies from a different virus. But those things haven't been flushed out yet. I think it's a great idea in theory. I think we'll get there. We're not there yet. And I certainly wouldn't bank my life on it in terms of what the results of an antibody test would be showing. I'm hopeful, like I said, in the coming weeks, in the coming months, these will get better, they'll become more accurate, and there will be some utility. But as of right now, Dr. Fauci, as well as the World Health Organization, say that they shouldn't be used for an immunity passport.
Could it help, though, in the future development of vaccines to have antibodies or use antibodies?
Actually, we're using that right now, and that's something called convalescent plasma. And we've actually, that's been approved, and we've actually used it here, even in our region, to help patients with COVID-19. And the way that works is that we find patients that have had COVID-19 that we know have had it, they've then cleared it, and then we get their antibodies through plasma donation. And then we inject that plasma into critically ill patients through an IV form to be able to help them. And that actually has been successful. So in terms of our critically ill COVID-19 patients and those on the ventilator or those in the intensive care unit, that actually is very promising and has shown to be positive. So very excited about the use of that.
Let's talk about vaccines. There are some that have talked about that it could be 12 to 18 months away. Take us through the process of developing vaccines. Why does it take so long to come up with that?
Oh, so vaccines are obviously another hot topic. So yeah, I'm glad that question came up. Right now, as of today, we have two companies that have gone into phase 2 trials on vaccines. There's lots of companies trying to do it, a big race to get the vaccine out. One of them is from Oxford over in England, and another one I think is a U.S.-based company. And so a big race for that. As you might imagine, this vaccine needs to be safe, and it needs to be effective, and it needs to be widely available. So we need to make sure that if we're going to try to vaccinate or provide a vaccine for over 300 million people, that it doesn't have a contaminant, that it works, that we have enough for everybody. And so lots of things go into that. When we talk about the testing for vaccines, there's different phases. Phase one means you've created the vaccine and you're going to test it. And you're going to test it on a few dozen people. And you're going to see how they react. And you're going to see if it works. You're going to go back and test them. And you're going to look for any side effects or any ill effects from the vaccine. And if that seems okay, then you're going to go to phase two, which is a few hundred people, maybe 500 or 600 people. And you do the same thing. We tested a larger number. Let's see how they react to it. Do you have any side effects? Is there any? And so they're following both groups during all of this. Phase three is a few thousand people. And so now they get several thousand people and they give them the vaccine. And again, they follow them, look for side effects and all of that. And they're following all three of these groups. You have to go through all those phases before you can even make application to the FDA to start mass producing it. So that takes several months to go through that before you can get to the point where you would even go to a production company and produce the vaccine. When we talk about, I'm going to take a step back, when we talk about our flu vaccine, there's a specific scenario in how we create those. And we actually create them somewhat differently. The reason why is because we've already got FDA approval. We've already done all the trials. We've already done all the phases for our flu vaccines. We just really just reintroduce the strain that we need for that upcoming fall. And so it's vaccines are created differently depending on the type of vaccine. This is a brand new vaccine. We don't have a coronavirus or a COVID vaccine out there. So it's not like the flu vaccine that we've used for decades. And so that's why it takes longer. There have been some reports about, oh, we hope to have one by, you know, sometime in the fall or by the end of the year. The truth is, we'll be lucky to have one by the first of 2021. We'll be lucky to have a safe, effective vaccine that's available to everybody by, you know, early to mid 2021. That's the truth about it. I would love to see a vaccine come out sooner. I might have a little bit of suspicions because, again, recognizing what's needed to make a safe and effective vaccine, it's not a process you can necessarily rush.
So what we're doing right now is what we're going to be doing for quite a long time is what you're basically saying.
You know,
for those people who are wondering about that.
And that's the truth, Jonathan. And here's that comes into a whole other conversation, which is basically pandemic fatigue, which people are already experiencing. And I'm probably as worried about that as I am the virus in terms of, you know, as a generation, pretty much no one, you know, living today has really been through something like this to this level. And, you know, we're used to going through something, getting over it, moving on with our lives. You know, things occur, you know, fairly quickly, so to speak, things that, you know, that hit a certain segment of the population. Doesn't involve everybody. It doesn't involve the entire population globally. And so that's kind of where we are now. And so there's a level of basically impatience that's going on that can turn to, you know, quickly turn to social disruption, those kinds of things that I worry about as we move through this, because we're not close to being over for this. As someone had asked me before about, so, you know, what do you think about what our status is? I said, I think we're at the end of the beginning. I said, I think we're just now kind of at the point where we've had a first, you know, small exposure to what this is like, but we're not even close to what we're going to see in the coming months and into the fall.
So let's talk about that as people are starting to look at the fall and the winter. Some are predicting second waves of this. Is there truth that the second wave of this could be worse than the first? I know people have heard that, but what are your thoughts on that?
So there was I do believe there will be subsequent waves. The literature that I've been reading and the research I've been looking at does point in that direction. There was a really good publication that came out from the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota, and they put out about three different scenarios. And I think that those scenarios are probably pretty spot on, and certainly some of the scenarios that we're seeing playing out in other countries right now, where you'll see these peaks, and then it'll drop, and then it'll go back up, and then it'll go back down, it'll go back up. And so one of the scenarios does in fact show that we'll have, certainly here in the United States, another peak in sometime in June that'll fall back off, followed by another larger peak in the fall. There's two things that really make a difference in terms of what happens on these peaks. Number one, it's how the population reacts. So it's what people do, you know, in terms of social distancing and wearing of masks and hand washing and all of that, because there's no hand washing police out there. If you don't wash your hands, the only person that doesn't know that is you. The virus is going to spread either way. And again, as we reduce social distancing and come back together in clusters, that will affect the spread of the virus as well. And so I think you'll see cases go up. I think people will get concerned. They'll be more diligent. And these follow, by the way, probably 4 to 6 week averages. So as you implement something and you can follow this precisely from each country, there's great information out there, and you can actually see where each country put into place their lockdowns or their social distancing, and you can see that it took several weeks. They were still on the upcline. It took 4 to 6 weeks for that to really take effect before you saw the downtrend. And then once the downtrend occurred and they started having loosening of social distancing, there was a lag period of several weeks, and then all of a sudden the cases saw an uptick. So there's a lag in what you see. And I'm not sure that the general public really appreciates or understands that. There are scenarios that show smaller curves, but every one of the scenarios that I've looked at show peaks and valleys, certainly through the rest of 2020 and into 2021. Again, depending on a vaccine, depending on medications that come about. And there's a small group, and we've seen this in a couple of research articles. There's a small group that we've isolated of the virus that shows a tendency to burn out. We saw that back in the 2003 SARS outbreak, that it just kind of abruptly burned out. There were fingers crossed that this might do that. It's extremely rare. The few isolations of the virus that we found have been like 1 out of 16,000, positive, or 1,600, excuse me, 1 out of 1,600 positives showed that genetic mutation. So it's not likely that that'll happen. I mean, we could just kind of keep our fingers crossed and pray that it would, because that's something that a coronavirus can do, is it can burn itself out. We just don't see this one doing that right now.
So with the flu coming, that we know the flu season's coming, in the fall and in the winter, and with the possibility of this, how do you think the state can be prepared when we're dealing with this right now, and then we know that a second wave may be coming in that time when the flu season's going to hit? That has to be very concerning for you.
It's extremely concerning from a public health standpoint. And so these are the things that people need to understand. Now, one of the things that's good is that the social distancing measures that we have in place, they work for pretty much any infectious disease. So they'll work for the flu as well. So if you're wearing your mask, yes, you're protecting yourself from COVID-19. You're also protecting yourself from the flu. Hand washing protects yourself from the flu as well as other things that you could pick up. So it would be nice to see our flu numbers not necessarily go up, because we're actually doing some of these measures to protect individuals and ourselves from COVID-19. We do expect another wave, certainly here in Arkansas and in our region. We do expect another wave of this in the summer and subsequent waves after that, especially when schools return. We also know our resources are going to be tight. We already talked about the PPE, and we talked about the resources that will be available to the hospitals. It's going to be interesting to see how all of this plays out. One of the things that I think the listeners need to be very clear on is that there's things you can do to protect yourself from the flu. There is absolutely zero reason why you would not get a flu vaccine. If you are able to, and your doctor says it's safe, everyone should get a flu vaccine. I hate to say this, but that's pretty much a no-brainer, certainly for this upcoming fall. And the new studies show that you should not necessarily get it when it immediately comes out. We used to say that as soon as the vaccine's available, you should get it. But recent studies over the last several years have showed that really there is a little bit of waning that we didn't expect that occurs with that vaccine. So for the vast majority of individuals, they should get that vaccine in October. The flu vaccine should be taken in October. It shouldn't be. If it comes out August 1st, you should not get it August 1st. That was the latest information from the CDC, and your listeners can verify that on the CDC website under flu.gov. But again, we have medications for the flu. That's nice. We had rapid flu tests, but it is concerning, and not just for the flu, but all the other fall-like viruses that circulate, just the common cold viruses that also circulate in the fall.
Dr. Spites, we're about out of time, but before I let you run, anything else you would like to add about this, please?
You know, I think the biggest take home for your listeners is that it's certainly not over. I think mental health and mental wellness need to be paramount in terms of how we handle this individually, how we handle this as families, how we handle this as groups to get through this. And we will get through this. This is not something that's going to last forever. It just feels like it lasts forever. As I told my college age daughter, this too will pass and we'll get through it and we'll be better because of it. It's just going to take some diligence on our part to adhere to really what's right to keep everybody safe. And, you know, even those individuals who say, you know, well, I'll take the risk getting it. It's not about you. It's about the people that you know that you have yet to come in contact with that you're passing the virus on to unknowingly. So if you're not going to protect yourself, at least do it to protect those around you and those you come in contact with. So I guess that would be it. Those would be my closing comments.
Dr. Shane Spites is the Dean of the NYIT College of Osteopathic Medicine at Arkansas State University. Thank you so much for your time. We look forward to having you on in the future to keep talking about this as it continues to go along throughout the year. So thank you so much for your time, sir.
Absolutely, Jonathan. Thank you. Always glad to talk to you and help clear up some things for your listeners.
You've been listening to COVID-19 Questions and Answers on KASU. More information is available on our website at kasu.org. Go to that for the coronavirus page, where we have a lot of information there for you, keeping you up to date with the very latest numbers. And also, we do cover for you the press conferences as they're made available from Arkansas Governor Asa Hutchinson. We do bring those to you as well. So once again, thank you for listening to COVID-19 Questions and Answers on KASU 91.9 FM. And also, streaming live on kasu.org. I'm Jonathan Reeves. Arkansas Roots is next.